Welcome everyone to this interview where I am really excited to be talking with Saeed Dalabani. Firstly, Saeed, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
I've been looking forward to this interview. I first met Saeed, it must have been 5-6 years ago, I think it was, where we did an interview in, it was Mill Valley, just outside San Francisco, wasn't it? An interview around Saeed's work with evolutionary economics. And Saeed's got an extensive background working particularly with Don Beck, who was the creator of, or at least the developer of a lot of the ideas within Spiral Dynamics. And Saeed and I have had a little bit of contact also through the integral world over the years. And I noticed earlier this year that Saeed shared a post on Facebook that he'd written this book, The Light of Ishtar, which we're going to be talking a little bit about in this interview. And Saeed, perhaps we'll say a little bit more himself about this in a moment, but Saeed's wife has been through an incredibly difficult journey. Well, they've been through a difficult journey together. And we'll talk a bit about some of the details of that. But what really touched me in the book, and what I feel is a really important part of the dialogue within this conference, is the lived journey of going through something which is incredibly painful and difficult and traumatic, and the reality of that. Because I think often when we talk about trauma, we can talk about it in sort of neat ways, like trauma is something that happened in the past, or trauma, it meets this kind of simple kind of models of understanding it. And certainly in my life, in my own way, and I think it's true for many people, that the struggles we have often are alive and they're difficult and they don't have neat and easy answers. So I feel this is a very important interview. And Saeed and I talked a bit a few weeks ago, and I really appreciated some of the things that which we'll come to, that I feel Saeed is also the voice of a lot of people, I think, that are watching this conference, that are battling and living with these challenges in a daily basis. Saeed, so welcome again. I really appreciate you being here. I know this is a sensitive and vulnerable subject we're talking about, so I really appreciate your willingness to have this conversation with me. Do you want to just give a little bit of a frame and a context to just the kind of bare bones of the journey that you've been on over these recent years? And we can kind of give folks that foundation, and then we'll travel from there.
Yeah, sure. At about the year 2014 or so, I've noticed my wife Elsa was experiencing some mild cognitive impairment. And at the time, didn't really think much of it, but her situation over the years started getting worse, in a sense that her behavior was becoming somewhat noticeable with friends and colleagues and around work and matters of that nature. We sought the help of the American medical community here, from neurologists to psychiatrists and everyone in between. And basically from the year 2014 on to the year 2018, we were told this was a very stubborn form of depression that is curable through different types of therapies. Well, in 4 years, we went through 7 or 8 different therapists. We got opinions of 3 different neuropsychologists, and were under the care of 3 different psychiatrists. And the simple things that I observed that were progressively getting worse had evaded any explanation from the medical community. You know, simple question such as, you know, Elsa's been in therapy for 3 years. Why hasn't her ability to speak in full sentences have gotten any better? And to me, or to the medical community, actually, that translated in their minds as a failure in providing adequate service. So over the years, that sort of culminated with me being quite upset with the established medical community, and began to seek answers somewhere else. long story short, in 2018, Elza thought she was experiencing symptoms of a stroke. So I rushed her to the hospital, and after running certain CT scans, the doctor in the emergency room said there's no signs of a stroke, but there seems to be significant atrophy in the frontal and temporal lobe. And to me, that was tragic as well as comforting. Tragic in the sense that it was a confirmation of this was something neurological that was progressive, and comforting in the sense that I wasn't going crazy in 4 years going to different people in the medical community who kept trying to convince us that this was nothing more than a stubborn depression. Long and short of it, Alex, is in 2018, Elza was diagnosed with a rare progressive brain disease called frontotemporal dementia, one of the several dementias. It's considered one of the really worst ones. She is coupled with primary progressive aphasia, which has caused her to lose her ability to focus and to speak. And a possible, not confirmed yet, diagnosis of early onset Alzheimer's. So this is where we are today. I have, you can deduce that our lives have changed considerably in the last 5 or 6 years or so. And so this is where we are today. You know, I am humbled by the experience that I've been through. At this stage in my life, I'm not chasing, unfair economic systems, trying to make them more conscious. I'm just focused on moving life day at a time. And that's where we are.
And I think one of the things that is, I feel so important about the story is, and if I'm going to quote something you wrote in the book, actually, that I thought was really powerful, that how can a person process grief over any loss when the experience itself violates the loosest clinical definition of grief, i.e., that the love of your life, you're also your business partner, someone that you've spent a great deal of your adult life with, is there but not there. And in a sense, we tend to talk about trauma or grief as something that's happened that we have to get over. But when one's living with that, which I think is a lot of people's experience in different ways, that makes it very difficult to process that in the ways that one would expect, right?
You know, how can someone process grief when most of the modern world, most of psychotherapists basically tell you that grief is a one event in most cases that allows for efficient processing of emotions and the five stages of grief that you go through. You process it, you move on, you get to the stage of acceptance. You know, that's usually the toughest part, but sooner or later you move on with your life. Well, this is not that. And the deeper I looked into really why I was grieving so deeply about what was going on with us, is that I realized this is a world that lives on the meritocracy of the mind. And what I was grieving is the loss of Elsa's brilliant brain. She had an incredible spiritual presence to her. She had a powerful, a feminine power presence to her. She animated this trio of me, her, and Don Beck for almost 2 decades. And we were only able to accomplish the things we accomplished in the Middle East, in our earlier journey when trying to bring peace between Israelis and the Palestinians, due to Elza's unabashed determination to try to do something about the conflict. And Don Beck wasn't going to do it without her. And, I was, okay, come along, do the supportive work. Don and I need to do this. And I, initially moved into that space reluctantly, but then later realized, wow, this is really important. This is way more important than anything that I was doing at the time, which was being an executive in the real estate industry, building homes and you know, living the American dream and thinking that that's what life was all about. And so what I was grieving is the loss of that. And to a secondary degree, the loss of that three of us coming together, that the field that created in order to accomplish extraordinary things. So along with you know, Elsa's initial decline, Don Beck has experienced some decline himself as well, physically and cognitively. And so it's been difficult to maintain, you know, what I defined as the parameters of a healthy, conscious life less than 5 or 6 years ago. So yeah. It's been quite difficult. I would have been happy if I were just anyone grieving a normal loss. I would have been happy going to a therapist and allow the chips fall where they may. But as I explained earlier, the entire medical community, including the therapeutic community here in the States, have shown that they really don't care as much about you know, whether the nature of your decline is neurological that had no cure, or is it you know, something that we can try as much as we can to cure, knowing that, you know, in the background that this might not be curable. So in order for me to help myself process the trauma and the grief that I was going through, I dabbled into areas that usually most people don't dabble into. And that is, you know, as I describe in my book, I woke up one night from a nightmare repeating, you know, Joseph Campbell's quotation, which, you know, is probably one of the most popular quotations of his work, is that to follow my bliss, to follow your bliss. And it came to me as an awakening. It came to me as a knowing. You know, I've discovered that my bliss was my ability to express myself through my writings. And so it was through that I was able to first begin to journal about, you know, where Elsa and I were. So sort of being a witness to the events that were happening to us and taking it out of the subjective and maybe seeing it from more of a, you know, set your ego aside and see it from an objective perspective. And then, you know, the dabbling into the myth, the depth psychology, the spirituality, the philosophy, all came, it sort of rose on its own. I had to set my ego aside, saying, or very in a very difficult way, trying to convince myself that what the paradigm that existed for me 10, 15 years ago no longer exists. What would happen if I set that aside, even if it's just temporarily, if I can, and see what life is about without it? And it's because of that I was able to transcend most of the things that my ego was attached to. That is the, you know, although it was great work that Don, Beck, Elsa, and I did over the last 15 years, you know, the universe says, well, that was great, but, you know, reality is there are certain things that you can't control. And you have to transcend your ego that is attached to a certain outcome in order for you to understand it.
But what I think is also a really important part of this journey as well is that the journey to that place of acceptance wasn't a bypass around the difficult feelings and emotions. It was a journey through those feelings. Like one of the things that struck me in the book was obviously a lot of the work that you, Elsa, and Dom were doing was fighting injustice. And there's some powerful, I should say to people, the book is written by you, but it also includes excerpts from Elsa's writing as well. And she also writes of that. And I said to you last time we spoke that I particularly liked the moment where you really allowed yourself to have your rage and your anger at, you know, at Don. And there was a bit about Ken Wilber's bald head that made me laugh out loud. But say a bit about that embracing of just the truth of how you were feeling and why that was important.
Well, Alex, I call that my journey into the dark night of the soul. And if you've listened to many of the spiritual teachers out there, that is really a very sacred journey that begins when the universe begins to show you signs of what lies beyond the identity that you created for yourself. And so suddenly, the things that you've known stop making sense. Repeating the same task, expecting, old results doesn't make sense anymore. And, suddenly the world starts collapsing on you piece by piece. And initially, my reaction to that, because, I'm a man of the world. I don't live on a mountaintop meditating all the time. There was a tremendous attachment to the things that we held near and dear, and thinking that it was all conscious pursuits. You were absolutely right in the sense that we were, looking to fix injustice everywhere it existed. And that, as noble as that is, it also adds to your ego. And so when you begin to see it all go away, you look to, or at least in my case, I look to blame those who were responsible to tell us, to do that was all okay. And so, I talk about how my transformation in my own journey into my own, a night of the soul began initially with me, blaming the gods, blaming the universe, trying to bargain with. I mean, I followed the five stages of grief without even knowing that I did. It's a natural process that occurred. So I blamed, the hugest net I can cast, blaming the gods, the universe, and when that reality didn't yield, I resorted to the gods in physical form. And so, and so in one of the fit of anger, I projected all that on the first person I projected it on was Clare Graves. He tempted us into following his teachings, and that's really what attracted Elsa and I to do the work. And as if that wasn't enough, it was Don who had and again, this is just me tapping into the spiritual answers that I need to have me convinced that this issue was far greater than what my ego can understand or tap into the greater forces that could provide me an explanation. Sadly, it all showed up in blame and anger and, examining, the faults of everyone else except mine. But the culmination of that was that night of fit of anger towards Graves, Beck, and Wilbur. And it was just an all out, USOBs, this is not what this is supposed to be about. How dare you, lead Elsa into the forbidden territory of trying to fix the patriarchy in the Middle East when the gods have decided a long time ago that that's forbidden territory. And so I had to understand it from that perspective in order for me to come to a space where that night was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yes.
And I talk about what followed. What followed was a dream that I had. And I'm a believer in dream analysis through, Jungian therapy. And that's what Elsa used to do whenever her and I would have an archetypal dream. We would analyze it the next day. And without a doubt, that night I had an archetypal dream that Graves and I were kindred souls, and we were just sitting in his office behind my desk in my executive swivel chair and just shooting the breeze and, smiling and looking out. And I woke up the next day and for the first time in months, Alex, I felt like there was a sense of freedom, a sense of peace, a sense of ability to say, wow, all that has been clamoring at me had disappeared. And it was then that I began to really process my own emotions. It was then that I began to realize that all that was due to the limitations of my own ego. And that
But there's something that I think that's so important, that one can know that as an idea, but to feel that in one's heart, you have to embrace all that you feel, right? You had to let yourself have the rage, the anger, the frustration to find that place of deeper acceptance.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I'm not saying that, you know, that was the magical night that it all went away. There remains triggers. I mean, there's still, although they're far and few in between, there are still triggers that, you know, sent me on an anger fit that I can't control, but they're less guttural than they used to be. They come with the understanding that, you know, what I'm in a different space where I was in 2018.
But I think it's also part of what to me is so important about this is we're talking about a living, unfolding story. And as part of that, you know, there's one can have that place of deeper acceptance, but there's also still the place of having to live with the day-to-day reality and the frustrations. And let's maybe touch a little bit on the, you kind of touched on it briefly earlier, but the interactions with the medical community, what you call in the book the healthcare industrial complex, in a sense, at times, absence of empathy and compassion, and the being too quick to make diagnoses and too quick to follow and not question diagnoses. Maybe say a bit about that piece as well.
Yes. Well, our first experience with into examining what's going on with ELSA came with our first visit to a research neurologist at the local research institute here, a renowned institute in Southern California, who basically administered some standardized testing for her to see if there's cognitive decline that might indicate any neurological disorders, primarily progressive neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's. And at the end of that, he concluded that although there is some atrophy of brain tissue, it's not a source of concern, and recommended that we see a neuropsychologist who could prescribe a therapy treatment. But at the bottom of that four-page report, in the fine print, it mentions things that only came back to me after the diagnosis in that emergency room was made 40 years later, that what the atrophy could mean is a list of things. And one of those things on there was primary progressive aphasia and frontal temporal dementia. You don't read the fine print. You just listen to what the renowned neurologist says. And so we took his advice. We went to the neuropsychologist, who also ran a battery of tests and determined that, ELSA's therapeutic needs were not being addressed adequately, and put us through the rigor in Rome of going through a specialized psychiatrist who recommended a psychologist. And so long story short, my indication on whether ELSA was progressing in her therapy or not was, is she happier? Can she focus? And is her ability to speak has gotten any better? Because by 2017, Alex, she was barely able to compose a sentence. And our neurologists kept dissuading us from the idea that this was a neurological issue. And so so we kept changing doctors, thinking that someone would think outside the box. And I finally came to the realization that this is an unspoken reality for them. That if you're familiar with the spiral dynamics model, the green value system has taken over psychotherapy. That humanitarian psychology, humanistic psychology, prevails. It doesn't matter what your genes say. It doesn't matter what heredity says. When 50 years ago, one of Graves' most famous quotes was that what determines psychology is the lottery of the brain. and that the lottery of the brain in a lot of cases carries certain genetic markings that, you know, research cannot cure, that, you know, the most recent advances in epigenetics cannot address. And not once was that brought up with the medical community. The last neurologist we went to, which was the third within our healthcare system, we had to wait 4 months to see him because he was apparently the most prominent neurologist. And we waited for the appointment, and we were there less than 15 minutes. The minute he sat Elsa down, he gave her the same exact tests that were on, you know, same exact sheets as the two other neurologists gave her to examine whether her issue was, you know, a progressive neurological issue. And, you know, after he asked her a few questions, she was hesitant in giving answers, but she gave the right answers. And immediately after giving the correct answers, he sort of closes his laptop and says, this is a therapy issue. Her memory is fine. And I'm like, excuse me, we waited for this appointment for 4 months. Are you telling me all neurodegenerative diseases are related to memory?
And I just to interrupt you, I just want to really speak to this moment, because I think many people have had this frustration of instinctively, either for themselves or for the person that they're caring for, instinctively, intuitively, maybe even logically, they know that something's not right. They know that something's wrong, and they're not getting understood. They're not getting listened to. And particularly, diagnoses tend to just follow people around. And once someone's given a diagnosis, the danger is everyone else looks at the diagnosis and just, it's almost like a confirmation bias. They look for the evidence to confirm what they're already seeing. And I think I'm really happy we're talking, not happy obviously being through the experience, but I'm happy we're having the conversation about this, because I think it's a rarely talked about but incredibly frustrating and difficult thing.
Yes. And I think you're absolutely right. There seems to be a theme in the industry that you are not to violate another prominent physician's diagnosis. If you do so, you'll be ostracized from the entire medical practice. And although I don't have an actual confirmation of that, that seems to be the repeating theme with us that followed us for 4 years. And so after that experience with that neurologist, you know, it was the emptiest feeling I've had in a long time. It was a punch in the gut that I decided, you know, this is nothing but a false journey into what promises to be a return to how things used to be. And these are nothing more than tricksters.
You called it in the book, the High Priestess of False Hope. I thought that was a really powerful frame to put on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that came from, you know, after we pretty much exhausted the network of our healthcare organization, our Elsa's primary care physician says, look, you've pretty much exhausted all resources that we have. Maybe it's time for you to go outside the network. And that's what we did. He recommended someone who's in private practice, a brilliant young psychiatrist. And we thought, well, since it's going to be private pay, I can ask her questions that she's maybe not beholden to a certain, you know, insurance requirements to answer differently or things of that nature. And surely enough, she threw out the diagnosis that everybody was working with for the previous 3 years and changed Elsa's diagnosis from major depressive disorder to type 1 bipolar. And so, you know, I began to breathe a sigh of relief as we began to see some progress. But then within a few short months, you know, all the progress that was made was reversed. And then, you know, the doctor changed the diagnosis from bipolar type 1 to bipolar type 2. And treating for either didn't show any promise. And so that's when I, you know, confronted her about this being neurological. And
which I think also, sorry to interrupt you, Saeed, again, but I think it's another important point I just want to highlight here, which is that until one gets accurate diagnosis, you can't put in place the right treatment pathway. And in a sense, that's, I think, part of the frustration, but it's also the importance of people battling and fighting to get the right diagnosis, because otherwise you're spending energy and hope and time and money doing intervention that is just not going to be effective.
Yes, yes. So what we did after that, Alex, is I sought the advice of someone who is an outsider to our healthcare community, a person who Elzad and I would have not met if it weren't for her work with Don in the Middle East. And he was a friend of a friend who is a practicing neuropsychologist in Upper State New York, who practically wrote the desk reference for neuropsychology, and was, you know, he had heard of the work that Elza and Don were doing in Israel and Palestine, and our friend said, you can call him anytime you want, and surely enough, we called that individual, and you know, after I described Elza's symptoms on the phone to him, he says, I'm afraid this is not an issue that could be resolved in therapy. And that's when we first heard the term primary progressive aphasia. And I asked what it could be related to, and that's when he mentioned the frontotemporal dementia. And so all this happened while we were still in treatment with the high priestess of false hope. And so after her second diagnosis of bipolar 2 failed, I confronted her with this. I said, you know, we have a friend, and I told her what his credentials were, who thinks that this is aphasia. Why haven't you and your colleagues mentioned any of this? And her standard answer was just like everyone else's. You know, this person is not licensed to practice medicine in California, and I wouldn't listen to him. And so after her diagnosis and me repeatedly asking about, well, you know, have you considered, you know, other alternatives that are based in neurology, not psychology and psychiatry. And she kept evading the right answer till Elza had reversed all the progress that she had made under her care. And that's when she realized that that even her treatment has failed. And that's when she placed a referral to the Neurology Institute, which eventually, you know, confirmed the diagnosis that was made in the emergency room completely by accident, by someone who wasn't familiar with the narrative of what had happened in the last 4 years. It was an emergency, room physician who was just looking at some CT scans of the brain.
He wasn't blinded by the previous narrative and just the confirmation bias of, I'm just going to look for the evidence that supports what I'm seeing.
Yeah. Exactly. He wasn't afraid of being reprimanded by the highest rated neurologist in San Diego. He was just doing his emergency room diagnosis, which ultimately turned out to be the right diagnosis. So, you know, that runaround, you know, throughout that whole period of time, the hero archetype in me always put his best foot forward. And by the time the diagnosis was made, I was completely exhausted. I was at a place where, you know, someone or other subpersonality or other self needed to take over to bring this whole thing together. And that's when I began to, you know, really try to set aside everything about even thinking about what a return to what life used to be like, you know, pre-2014, and began to deal with the reality the way it is.
I think what's also important to add into this side as well is that I think it's only because of your significant business and kind of intellectual capacity, let's say, from previous kind of things in your life, that you had the dogged determination and the capacity to keep pushing and challenging to get the diagnosis, right? I mean, we could still be here two, three years later and still not have that clarity. And I wonder what helped you keep pushing, in a sense, when you were just kept getting these walls of ignorance, honestly. I mean, what for others in the same situation with someone that they love or they themselves, and they know they haven't got the clarity. What helped you keep pushing through?
Well, a couple of things, Alex. First, you know, I'm a researcher by the very nature of the work that I do, you know, with economics and, you know, the just the nature of the business that I've been engaged in my whole life. I research everything, and I'm a believer in science. I do believe in, you know, finding answers to the secrets of the universe, as the Orange System is known to be, through research and, you know, scientific methods, that research and development, all the things that transcend subjective opinions about these things. And so I've researched everything possible, and I looked into possible misdiagnoses on issues like this, and what doctors could be missing. The other aspect of this is both of my brothers, my older brother and my younger brother, are doctors. And so I reached out to them. And, you know, my older brother knows how to navigate the medical system and you know, manipulate it to my advantage. And he let me in on some of these secrets on how to, you know, get our insurance company, for example, to be able to cover a treatment that wouldn't normally be covered. And my younger brother was head of research at a pediatrics division in a hospital where he, you know, when I told him I wasn't convinced of the current diagnosis that was being told, that we were being told, he decided that, you know, he was going to come and visit and gather all of Elsa's records, including her CT scans, her MRIs, and her PET scans, and the history of treatment and the list of her medications. And he convened a hospital-wide meeting on, you know, basically saying, look, this is my sister-in-law. Please, you know, don't feel like you're limited to you know, what you might be afraid of a government, of a hospital administrator to do, or any insurance company to do. I want your full honest opinion on this. And so having access to these things enabled me to look beyond the narrative that was developed through our healthcare system here, that this was a treatable diagnosis. And by the time my younger brother got back to me, he says, I'm sorry, her condition is so advanced, there's nothing we can do. And to me, that was a wake-up call that really started me thinking into how deceptive the entire medical community is, especially when it comes to issues of neurodegeneration where the medical community knows there is no cure for. And they perpetuate the myth that this is curable, maybe for some unspoken purpose to collect as much of, you know, the insurance benefits as possible. And then when the truth comes, they, like I say in the book, they're like cockroaches in white lab coats that scurry to their hiding places. They're nowhere to be found.
And there's something about the importance of self-advocating, right? Like being willing to take on that battle. And in a sense, you know, sometimes it, you know, of course it's not always like this, but sometimes it really is like you're going to war. Like you're having to get as strong an argument as you can. You're having to get the best, you know, advice that you can, the best professionals on your side that you can. And I think it only adds to the trauma and the frustration of you're already dealing with something incredibly difficult, and now you've got this extra layer on top. And I wonder what you'd, you know, it, obviously it's a journey that's still being lived, but at least having now got that clarity, what would you say to folks that are watching this that are still on that journey to get clarity, that, yeah, to help them keep pushing for that?
Well, I would say try to get as much of an outside opinion on professional opinion on the conditions that you're dealing with as much as you can. This is, from my experience, this is really a systemic problem. And you're really fighting a system that is not set up for prevention and issues of whole care. They're really set up to cater to insurance costs. They're to give you minimum possible service and to avoid having you exhaust every penny of your benefits. It's just the entire experience, Alex, left a really bad taste in my mouth in as far as dealing with the entire medical community. And so here I am dealing with a huge system that thinks in those terms. And on the other side, I have, you know, two or three people that are on my side that are saying, well, no, this is wrong. And so imagine the size of the battle. This is a David versus Goliath kind of deal. And so the battle is uphill, but I encourage people from pursuing it. I encourage people from getting second opinions, even if it costs a little more money outside your own insurance network, just to get yourself some peace of mind. I would go to a non-conventional therapist if it's an issue of deep trauma that doesn't resolve. I would seek alternative therapy. I would consult with, you know, other aspects that I discuss in my book, tap into my spirituality, tap into other realms that are not necessarily, traditional medicine. Those are the things that helped me. And I hope, you know, with me talking about them, that triggers some interest in your viewers to pursue.
And I think what's also, I'm really keen to highlight here that these journeys are happening simultaneously, right? There's the journey of taking a spiritual lens and letting your ego be battered to pieces in a sense, and the potential for awakening that comes from that, whilst at the same time getting up and having to take on these battles with the medical kind of complex. And it's not an either or, right? And it's not a neat, tidy journey that you do this piece and you package that piece away and then you do this piece. It's in a sense following your inner compass along the way of just what's the thing that's most important to give my attention to today.
Right. So along this journey, Alex, what I realized is there's no map to it. There is no certain guide to guide you through it. You take it a day at a time. And you really don't know what the medical community is going to throw in your way. You don't know what the universe is going to throw in your way. You don't know if you're going to be able to meditate on issues that are that need to be resolved. That you need to bring yourself up to a higher level of spiritual understanding to accept. You know, all these things are constantly doing battle with the situation to have it take shape, and it's like you're almost helpless in giving it direction. And so, you know, I mean, you talk about surrender. This was the place of surrender for me, is that, you know, I can't control anything, and, you know, let the higher powers take charge of this and see where they may lead me. And you know, after a while, you learn that surrender is quite a peaceful place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm mindful of time, Saeed, but I'd love to also just to talk a little bit about towards the end of the book, you say that a friend recently asked if I'd processed grief, and you answered, I'll let you know when I get there. And I thought that was beautiful, because I think, again, a lot of people's experiences, it's not something you deal with and you put it in a box. It's an unfolding journey.
It absolutely is. And, you know, you talk about trauma a lot in your series of talks, Alex. And to me, trauma appears in different forms to different people. Although, you know, like I said before, this is the kind of trauma that has really annihilated everything I have known for 15, 16 years, and had set me on a solemn journey to search for new answers. Recovery is not the same for everyone. It all depends on your past experience. It depends on your, you know, your cognitive abilities, your spiritual abilities, what your experience was in tapping into things that have made you happier, have helped you, you know, overcome things in the past. So yes, acceptance, you know, I could never say that I will ever get there. accepting the non-dual nature of, you know, life and death are the same. I mean, that you can't get into any higher level of realization than that. And so I work my way back from that, you know, that there's no difference between, you know, the work that Elsa and Don and I were doing in saving the Middle East to really being the caregiver for my ill wife. The, you know, not that non-duality makes it a lot easier for me to accept where we are. But acceptance is never final. There are constantly triggers. And, you know, like the other day, I was looking through our closet. And, you know, and I talk about when I first met Elsa and she was wearing a miniskirt, and I run into that miniskirt as I'm shuffling, and I completely broke down. And it's just, you know, those triggers show up in the least places you expect them. But then you have to learn to okay, well, that's just another small lesson in my progress towards a final state that might never be reached, a final state called acceptance. And so that's been my journey, and you know, but by no measure do I consider myself someone who has reached that final stage of acceptance and happiness. It's a work in progress, and very likely will continue to be a work in progress for many years to come.
What I really hear you say is acceptance is not a destination, right? It's a journey. It's a practice that one lives.
It absolutely is, and it's. I've learned that it is a journey that you know, the universe might throw certain complications on that road, on that journey, and you have to learn to accept it.
Yeah. I'm mindful of time, so I really want to recommend people check out your book, The Light of Ishtar. I think it's a powerful book, and I think it's. I'm so grateful for you being willing to come and have this conversation. I know it's very, very sensitive conversation. Is there anything you want to share in closing?
Yeah, I would tell people who seem to be into the spiritual community and working with therapy to explore other areas of their lives that they might have substituted spirituality and therapy for, that there is a totality of life. And to me, today is appearing to me in the smallest things. I derive pleasure from just, you know, taking care of my garden, or you know, cleaning my own backyard from dog poop. You know,
there's plenty of that in mine as well.
I talk about non-duality. I put that at the same level as, you know, speaking to a conference of the top financial global leaders in the world just a couple of years ago. It's you know, they're both the same. And so yeah, my recommendation is, you know, tap into other abilities that you have in order for you to help help you become well adjusted and happy. That'll be my advice. That'll be, you know, that's what got me to write the book and help me process much of the trauma that I've experienced since 2014.
Wonderful. Syed, thank you so much. I really appreciate your openness and willingness to this dialogue. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex, for putting this beautiful series on. It's very informative and very, very, very heart-touching.